From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1993 in the pages of a best-selling book. Listening to Prozac by writer and psychiatrist Peter Kramer examined the effectiveness of a drug that came with the promise of revolutionizing the treatment of anxiety and depression, a so-called miracle drug. In the book, Kramer made the case for SSRIs, or selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. He said the research shows they do work for many people in many ways, but they don't work all the time, and not for everyone. He stated, in effect, they aren't miracle drugs, but they can be life-saving. The book also explored the social and ethical implications of Prozac, asking, what does it mean when a capsule with breakfast makes a shy person outgoing? And what does it mean when a pill alters what we think of as personality, not illness? What does it mean to remake the self? Kramer's book became part of an ongoing conversation over the effectiveness of Prozac and other SSRIs. In 2010, Harvard psychologist Irving Kirsch published his own book, arguing that, in essence, antidepressants are not much more effective than placebos, and that, among other arguments like it in the ensuing years, brought Kramer back to the debate as what the Atlantic Monthly calls a reluctant and cautious warrior for the efficacy of antidepressants. This hour, we'll discuss his research, the science behind antidepressants, and the social and ethical questions that surround them. Peter Kramer's in town for a lecture tonight at the University of Rochester, but first, he's gracious enough with his time to join us here on Connections. It's nice to have you. Thanks for being
here. Thank you.
I want to let our audience know a couple of things here. First of all, he's speaking tonight, 5 p.m., in the Hawkins Carlson Room of Rush Reese Library at the University of Rochester. That event is free and open to the public, and it's part of the 2018 and 2019 Humanity Center Public Lecture Series, exploring the theme of expertise and evidence this year. I love that theme, and I have a direct appreciation not only for the value of expertise and evidence, but your own view of it, which is that over the years, your profession has sort of been more narrowly pushed into corners, it seems.
Right, yeah? Yes. No, I mean, in Freud's time, he was respected when he commented on anthropology, religion, politics, war. Nowadays, we have trouble getting believed about things we know well, which is the treatments we give our patients.
And it was 25 years ago, what I don't want to do is oversimplify your important and essentially a cultural touchstone, your first book. But I'm curious to know if you agree with the Atlantic Monthly that you've been sort of pulled back to the table reluctantly in this public conversation.
No, absolutely. I wrote Listening to Prozac as a sort of cultural commentary. I thought that I believed what some of my patients told me, that their personalities were tweaked in some ways by these early new antidepressants like Prozac, and wondered how hungry we were as a culture for things like assertiveness. I didn't think I was writing about medication or illness. I thought I was writing about who we are as Americans and wanted to pursue that. And of course, the success of that book kept pulling me back toward, you know, the publishers and so on wanted me to write about depression. Actually, my next book was about intimacy. It was called Should You Leave? And my following book was a novel. So I tried not to be roped in. But seeing patients, friends, fellow clinicians start doubting the effectiveness of antidepressants and appreciating their importance made me want to say, let's slow down a little. There's room for skepticism and cynicism, but we need to start from the premise that these medicines do work.
Yeah, and so I think it's important our listeners understand that Peter is not someone who thinks everyone should be on these medications or that they work all the time equally for everyone. But you are pushing back against a little bit of a tide against antidepressants. What do you think it comes from?
You know, psychiatry has always faced pushback. In the 50s and 60s, there was a movement called anti-psychiatry, which was worried that psychoanalysis was intruding on people's sense of self and defining who they were and trying to create certain kinds of people. And that movement moved very readily into opposition to medication and diagnosis. So it's sort of a skepticism about medicine's role in the broad area of psychology. In addition, I think there were people within psychiatry who, once they were tied to psychotherapy, were very reluctant to have medication treat the same patients. And the antidepressants in particular were threatening, because it turned out fairly early on to seem that antidepressants treated what had been called neurosis, depressive neurosis, so that chronic low-level recurrent depression responded fairly well to medication. Statistically, it responded better to medication than to psychotherapy, and that was threatening enough that there was a lot of pushback.
We're also looking at, you know, maybe a decade or so of articles, books, research, meta-analysis that says, well, here, you know, this is an indication that perhaps the placebo effect is strong in antidepressants. And I think your book does a number of things really, really well, not the least of which is you take some rather dense study and you break it down for us, I think rather patiently, and I appreciate that, in a way that says to us, not that scientific study should be invalidated. I don't take that at all. But we ought to be careful here because, especially when it comes to depression and antidepressants, there is sort of clinical study and what we would sort of broadly call science, and then there is treating the patient that we see who is a dynamic being in front of us. And if you're only relying on study, you got to ask yourself, what does study come from? So tell me about some of the issues with, for example, a meta-analysis.
Good. So, you know, I think we are clinicians. I just closed my practice, but for 40 years I treated patients. We see people get better on antidepressants. And I think when we start reading articles saying these medicines don't really work, when there's a conflict between what doctors see every day and over years and what new studies show, I think we want to look at them very carefully. Not to say that when, you know, there may not be a time, and certainly there have been, where established treatments are questioned. But we shouldn't, you know, leap to believe that the practicing doctors are wrong. So in the face of this challenge, I went back and looked at the literature. And one of the techniques that is used to create technical papers now is meta-analysis. Meta-analysis is a way to combine lots of small studies, some of which may contradict each other, and get one answer as if you had done a very large study. So a reasonable size study in medicine to really come to a conclusion has more than 1,000 patients in it. Well, studies in psychiatry will have 100 patients in them. So we don't get the kind of clear answer you get for things like blood pressure medicines. And the problem with meta-analysis is that it can be slanted. So one study that I talk about, there are people interested in placebo for whom placebo is sort of a cause, the notion that dummy pills do a lot to get people better. And I have lots of doubts about that. I think people respond to psychotherapy. I think in medical studies, people respond to the kind of support and attention they get. The notion that there's a lot of power in hopeful expectations attached to a pill is one that I think is, you know, really overplayed. So I'm happy to say more about meta-analysis.
But in terms of how some of these study, and the reason if this sounds technical to our listeners, I want to explain exactly why this matters. This matters because for a decade or so, we have seen a little bit of an erosion or at least doubts cast on antidepressants, et cetera. Right. And I'm wondering if you think that's dangerous.
I do. I mean, I started the book for a particular reason. I had a friend who'd had a stroke, a kind of stroke where you don't get enough blood flow to a part of the brain. And I heard about this not right away, but a few days later. So I wasn't in on the early response, which can be very, very important. But I thought I'd remembered that medicines like Prozac could be given to patients with this kind of stroke. It has nothing to do with their use in depression. It has to do with people's motor functioning, their survival. These are drugs that induce some kind of resilience in the brain, and I'd seen some studies that they were effective. So I went and looked, and sure enough, the kind of stroke he had was the kind where if you give Prozac for a short while in the early weeks, patients recover more function. So I found out that he wasn't on that treatment. I spoke to his neurologist, and the neurologist said, you know, I've been reading a lot that these medicines are just glorified placebos, and so I'm more reluctant to use them. And I said, hold on, you know, this has gone too far. And I sent the neurologist the articles and said, you know, come on, this is your patient. This is the evidence. You know, what do you think? And he did put my friend on the medicine, and I think we had a good response. You never know in one patient. But that made me think about this opposition, sort of ideological opposition to antidepressants. And so I looked at meta-analyses, and I saw some slanting, some of which seemed to me maybe to be kind of bad faith science, some of it maybe incidental. So, for example, what happens if you take all the studies that drug companies have done on antidepressants and you combine them? Well, let's say you have a new drug, and there was one at a certain point called Suzone or Nefazodone, that looks like it may treat depression in a different way than other antidepressants do. And the calling card for this drug is going to be that it doesn't have a lot of side effects. Well, the drug company, to satisfy the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, has to come up with two favorable trials that show the medicine works. But they can have a lot of unfavorable trials. So what the drug company may do is use a very low dose of the drug in the hope of showing that this drug really has fewer side effects than other drugs. And they'll do a lot of trials, and these trials, one after the other, will fail. They keep raising the dose, and eventually they get to a good dose, and the drug works or barely works. And if you then put all the trials together, you'll have a lot of bad trials for Suzone, so that you have one bad apple and it brings down the averages, and then it looks like on average antidepressants don't work. There are other problems. As you said, antidepressants really don't work for some people. So that if you just look at averages, it may be that people on placebo will get a little bit better, and people on medicine, some of them will get a lot better, and some really won't. Some will do really poorly. So the averages also are going to underplay these medicines and miss the people who just get better entirely on antidepressants. So the danger is that if you use meta-analysis the wrong way, you lose effective treatments. You have treatments that work, are very helpful to people, but you know, the numbers don't show that they work as well as they do in practice.
And now you have such doubt in antidepressants that you even have neurologists musing about, well, I think it's all just placebo. So to kind of, before we get to some of the really, I think, important and in some cases, personal stories from our listeners, but also the way this impacts people on a person-to-person basis, which we're going to get to with Peter Kramer in a moment, I just want to ask you to say a few words about placebo, because we hear it so often. And the takeaway for your readers seems to be that it is real, but it is much more limited than we've been led to believe, that maybe in cases of pain response, there's a chance, but it's not magic.
In pain response, there's a fairly good mechanism. Look, if you're an animal, mammal, you're injured, and there's some reason that you ought to go out and save yourself, you know, you ought to head back to your cave, whatever it is. We have some mechanisms that allow us to suppress pain. Our opioids come out in the brain and so on. So there are ways that hopeful expectancy produces responses to pain. For the rest of medicine, it's very limited. There's an article coming out in the New York Times, I guess this weekend or soon, about placebo, and Ted Kapchuk, who's probably the chief researcher on placebo at Harvard, really tries to damp down expectations about placebo. We're not curing cancer with placebo. So placebo, but there's another issue, which is, what is the placebo effect? Is it that we take a pill and we have lots of expectations, so the pill makes us better? Or is it that these pills are given in a context that is very supportive? One thing I do in this book, Ordinarily Well, is I go out to one of these test centers. It's not a pleasant view of how medicine is conducted, but one of these centers that does multiple tests of antidepressants. And testing antidepressants is hard because antidepressants work, and if you have depression and your doctor is an ethical agent, as he or she is likely to be, the doctor will put you on an antidepressant, or you'll get psychotherapy, whatever it is. We have effective treatments. So who is being used or volunteering to test out a new drug? Well, often it's people who are just about homeless. It's people with multiple problems. Often they've been in multiple studies. It's hard to recruit these patients. the drug testing is an important part of their lives. So I went on the van that goes around to the single room occupancies and picks up people. It takes them to their welfare to work setting. It brings them to the drug test center. Great danger for drug companies is dropouts in these trials. They want people to finish the trials. So they have a very pleasant fellow driving the van who supports them. The people know each other. They talk to each other. They support each other. They come in. They maybe get a sandwich, get some lunch. They get a lot of attention to their illness and their problems. And they're given a placebo. And then they start to get better. And the question is, you know, is it expectancy related to the pill, or is the whole framework important for the treatment of, you know, of any ailment? And I think it's just true that the medical setting can be very supportive to people, and that can be helpful for depression, some of the symptoms of depression, having people start thinking about themselves in different ways. So the question is what we're calling placebo. Is placebo that whole large thing, or is it the narrow thing?
My guest is Peter Kramer, author of Ordinarily Well, The Case for Antidepressants, in Rochester as a guest of the Humanity Center at the University of Rochester. And his event tonight is at 5 p.m. at Rush Reese Library. It is free. It is open to the public. And it's a good opportunity to learn from a voice who's now for 25 years been one of the leading voices in trying to understand SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, what we call antidepressants. Listeners, I know there's already a lot of email and comments on social media, and I'd love to hear from you. And I think in many ways for the rest of the hour, your comments will help guide this discussion because so much of what I'm already hearing from listeners it will be referenced at various points in the work that Peter has done over the years, and I think that will be instructive. You can call the program. It's toll-free, 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255. Or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Or you can email us, connections@WXXI.org. I want to start with some of the listener feedback on the subject of depression and antidepressants, with what takes us to a question of the subject of self. And some of our listeners describe being on antidepressants as a need for themselves, but also feeling they lose some of themselves, some of their creativity, some of their energy, some of their personality. Others view it sort of oppositely. And as I read through some of the remarks from our listeners, here is, I want to be careful with who I choose to read from here, but let me go ahead and read from Trish, who says that she essentially finds herself more easily when she is taking medication. Whereas others have written to us to say, you know, I recently went off of antidepressants and I felt like a wave of overwhelming emotion and a sense that I couldn't even barely even handle who I was. And I didn't even know because I'd been on antidepressants for so long. A woman writes to us and says, I felt like I'd lost who I was. And when I stopped taking medication, I finally realized who I was, but it was overwhelming. So two very different thoughts there on self.
Yeah.
Peter, what do you make of that contrasting idea there?
Well, you know, when I wrote Listening to Prozac, it largely was in response to what my patients said. And to my surprise, some of their comments were about self. That is, they might say, I'm myself at last. So they had, say, chronic, minor, recurrent depression. They went on a medicine and they enjoyed the things that they'd enjoyed as children. They had a better appreciation of their family, whatever it was, they were functioning better. And I thought, how strange is it the case that they would never have been themselves? What does that mean? That if this medicine had not been invented, if they had gone through this experience 20 years earlier, they would never have been themselves? What, you know, and I, my understanding of it was like having a migraine lift. If you had a chronic migraine, that when the migraine goes away, you say, you just know there's some marker for migraine that it's not who you are. And when the migraine goes away, you feel you're yourself again, or you're yourself at last. That it was something like that, that depression was the alien force and being without the depression was sort of the way we should be. It is also true that these are real medicines. They have side effects. And one of the things you can get on antidepressants in longer-term use is apathy. They probably change the way the brain communicates with itself. one way in the beginning, there's some adjustment, they start doing different things in the longer term. And I think people who get that effect of apathy when they come off the medicine really feel restored, even though they may feel they're sliding toward depression again, and they have a difficult choice. Do they want to go on the medicine and be muted in some way, or do they want to suffer from the depression? And there are lots of considerations in that choice.
How do we help people decide if a medication is helping them enhance or feel comfortable as themselves versus pushing them to feel things that are outside of what they might think is their own norm? For example, a shy person who suddenly becomes more gregarious.
Yeah. That was another motivation for this book 25 years ago, which was people becoming more assertive. And then the question is, you know, is the society pushing them to be more assertive? Is their employer, if it's a salesperson, mm-hmm. pushing the person to be more assertive? And, you know, what do we make of shyness altogether? That question, I don't know how much is original to me in listening to Prozac, but some of those questions I think were original to me, and people went out and looked at them afterwards. And it is the case that as people recover from depression, they tend to normalize, that is to go toward cultural societal norms on all sorts of factors, largely things like low energy, shyness, inhibitions, speech pace, those kind of characteristics. And the question is, to what extent we just say, well, that's an ailment, that's an illness. And there are lots of reasons to call depression an illness. People die younger who have depression, and not just of suicide. They die younger of cardiac disease. There are changes in their blood elements and their bone, and these are all, you know, negative changes, heart rhythm, way the body handles hormones. So you could just say, well, that's all part of this ailment. I think the other viewpoint, that a certain level of melancholy is in accord with humans' relationship with the world, you know, that's sort of the other argument.
Let me get a phone call, and then we'll start working through some of your emails and comments that have come in. This is Ben in Manchester on the phone. Go ahead, Ben.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question was, when the guest was talking about pushback in the 50s to medication, it was my understanding that around that time, a lot of people with depression and anxiety were being treated with tranquilizers, and that kind of pushback, I think, was warranted, because I don't know if that's the best idea for a lot of people.
Right. I think, you know, this is Peter Kramer. I think that's true. What happened, kind of give this history in the book, is that these medicines started coming into use in the late 1950s, and immediately there were complaints that this was a placebo effect from people who were more favoring psychotherapy. And the medicines weren't very well differentiated in the minds even of psychiatrists. So there were some articles at the time that complained about antidepressants, but when you looked in detail at who was being referred to, it actually was patients on the early anti-anxiety drugs like Miltown and then Valium and Librium. So there, I think some of the objection to antidepressants was in a confusion, even in the field, of the distinction between anti-anxiety drugs and antidepressants.
Okay, well, the larger point I was trying to make was that I think, given hindsight, it may be that a little bit of skepticism about SSRIs might be more appreciated in 2040, just like skepticism now is more appreciated about tranquilizers used in the 50s.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's certainly possible. I mean, I think something will be very wrong with psychiatry if we're still thinking a lot about SSRIs in 2040. I think these will be, you know, long bypassed in favor of better medications, more individualized medications. I wouldn't be surprised, actually, if the evidence we have now about SSRIs is about as far as we're going to go, because I think with you know, breakthroughs in our understanding of depression, there are also going to be breakthroughs in development of medications or other treatments.
But help me understand, Peter, you're saying that in another 25 years or so, we will have moved on beyond SSRIs to other classes of treatment?
I hope so, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, SSRIs seem to be helpful for about 75% of patients and very helpful for, you know, 40-50%, I would say. Some people would give a lower number for the very helpful. But there's certainly people they don't affect at all. I think they're, you know, they're clearly easiest and best use is short term. Depression is a long term recurring illness. So these medicines get used for longer and longer periods of time. They also don't work very fast initially. They do have some effects early, but they don't really get rid of depression very fast in the early going. So we would like better medicines.
Well, Trish writes, the worst part is when they stop being effective and you have to try a new medication. How common is that?
You know, I don't know that it's very common, but there's so many people on these medicines that even things that are not very common affect lots of people. And so this was sort of Prozac poop out, was called, you know, probably in the late 1990s, where people had been on the medicine for a while. And it was sort of hard to tell what was going on. Either their depression was just breaking through, or they were getting the kind of apathy that I talked about otherwise. There are always with these medicines some kind of catastrophic failures where people are doing well on the medicine, and then all of a sudden they do very poorly. This was truer probably of some of the earlier antidepressants. And then the question is, what's going to work? Doctors switch medicines. They add a second medicine. They try to go to a period off medication and reintroduce medications. There are other interventions now, like things that affect the brain through magnetism and electricity. I think to step back, I think the first message is depression is highly treatable, and we haven't emphasized psychotherapy enough. It's very helpful. Depression is highly treatable. There's hope. Most people with depression are going to get better. Some will get better with very simple interventions. But depression is also something where a lot of technical expertise is sometimes needed, in complicated cases.
From Don, he writes and says, I'm on an SSRI and just finished reading How to Change Your Mind by Michael Pollan, which discusses using psychedelics to treat depression. Mr. Kramer, have you looked into this? What's your take and how do they compare to SSRIs?
Right. I don't know. I have not looked into it. There are, you know, there's with sort of a kick the television theory about depression treatment in the early going that you needed to somehow perturb the brain dramatically to kind of reset it and allow it to start learning again, that the brain kind of got stuck on negative ruminations. And there was a sense that either dramatic kinds of psychotherapy or fairly powerful medications would allow the brain to reset. And it may be that something nonspecific like that is going on with some of the hallucinogenic drugs, but I don't know.
Talking to Peter Kramer, who is in Rochester as a guest of the Humanity Center and has a 5 p.m. event today, and a lot of our feedback on the subject of depression. Hillary writes to us and says, stopping antidepressants or SSRIs is quite difficult after you've been on them a while. There are very unpleasant side effects to discontinuing long-term antidepressant use. That's from Hillary. Peter?
So this is a hot topic. It's all over the web. People are writing about the difficulty of coming off antidepressants after long-term use. We don't know how common it is. There have been a few studies, but they're largely studies of people also recruited on the web or people speaking to their own contacts. So it's sort of a group speaking to itself. And there have been articles in the New York Times, the BBC has reported on this, but they're all based on this sort of vague public discussion. I suspect that these problems are less common than what we're reading about. I say this just as a practitioner and as someone who has spoken to other practitioners. I've gotten my patients off medications pretty readily, and there are ways to do it. Slowly is the answer. But when I've had to take patients off medication more quickly because they've gotten pregnant and we think it's the right time to come off, I've done pretty well as well. So I don't know how common this problem is. But, you know, if I'm taking people who've been on medicine a long time off on an elective basis, I'll do it over the course of a year. I think very slow taper is certainly the gentler way to come off medication.
Let's go to Penfield. This is Ingrid next on the phone. Go ahead, Ingrid.
I hope I'm not putting anyone on the spot. I have a weird question. I'm a dog trainer, and I feel like we are flying blind when we try to help dogs we suspect need drug interventions to help. You know, even before we can work with training, they're just too fearful or too anxious. I don't know if you would call it depressed. I don't know if that's appropriate. But I'm wondering, because they cannot self-report, are there measurable things that we could be looking at to know whether a drug is working?
So at the moment, no. I guess I don't know anything about this issue, but with people, I certainly am a psychotherapy first person, a doctor. I would always, if there wasn't an emergency, if suicidality wasn't an issue right away, if other things hadn't been tried yet, I like to sit with people, you know, for quite a while before we discuss whether medication is going to be appropriate. I certainly hear from veterinarians that these medicines like Prozac, you know, do work for anxious dogs. And I think in the case of, you know, are we going to put the dog down or try something first, you know, often they try medication.
Does that help, Ingrid?
That makes sense. Yes, thank you very much.
Okay.
I appreciate it.
Thank you, Ingrid. I appreciate that. Let's get our only break of the hour. And when we come back with Peter Kramer, the author of Ordinarily Well, The Case for Antidepressants, we're going to talk about the difference, I think fair to say, as he sees it, between the idea of doctors who are being asked to see averages and not see patients. And we're going to talk about what it means to see patients, not just see the results of clinical trials or scientific study. Peter is not anti-science at all, but he also is offering the importance of nuance in understanding person to person, case to case. And I think the New York Times keyed in on one of the really good vignettes in this book that helps indicate that if you are treating people, it's a dynamic challenge, but good doctors can do that. We're going to talk about how to do that next. Coming up in our second hour, Congressman Joe Morelli joins us in studio, fresh off his victory on Tuesday. He's already serving in Congress, filling the seat of the late Louise Slaughter, and getting ready to start his first full term in January. We'll also be joined by Nate McMurray, who is challenging Chris Collins and wants every vote counted before he concedes there, and Jen Lunsford, who nearly won a seat in the state Senate. That's next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. So if you are a doctor in practice and you're working with patients who have symptoms of depression, there is, you know, as we've talked about this hour, a decade or so of articles and even research and meta-studies questioning antidepressants or pumping up placebos, et cetera. And I think Peter reminds us of the importance of treating patients, not just sort of dealing with numbers and studies. And the New York Times keyed in on a patient that you called Olivia in your book. And the story goes that after a difficult divorce, years later, she finally decided to start to date and someone who ended up breaking her heart. And you wrote that it was a sequence that cried out for psychotherapy, but she doesn't have the resources to participate in conversation. She recycles recriminations against herself, all of these dynamic and difficult layered factors. But you started thinking about, well, as you write in the book, you know, what's going to make an impact for her? And you put her on Zoloft because you wanted to cut the loop of circular thinking, and you'd seen it work in situations before, and it seemed to work for her. Why do you think that helps illustrate a story in which treating patients is more sort of complex than just looking at studies and analyses?
Right. So I remember this case very well. It's obviously translated in certain ways in the book
Sure.
to protect the person. And, you know, here I think we're not looking at the level of depression. this person was just deeply stuck, was not progressing socially, and it was spilling over into her career. And I just thought, I've seen this circular thinking. I should have done this. He would love me. You know, if only I had done that. This kind of obsessive thinking just filling her life. We had done psychotherapy. I think she had a fairly good take on herself, but she was sort of stimulating herself with these recurrent thoughts. And I thought, all right, enough's enough. Let's discuss medication. She went on medication, and all of a sudden, she had a much more complex memory. I had been through the breakup with her, as it happens, in terms of time. I'd known about the guy through her descriptions. Her descriptions, while in this obsessive state, were entirely different from what they had been at the time. Hmm. On the medicine, she remembered. She thought he had his shortcomings. I was going to break up with him if he didn't break up with me. You know, there was this enormous decompression and relief where she was able to have a more complex view of what had happened. Somehow the brain was stuck in this, cycle of very limited self-undermining thought. And medication interrupted that. We stuck with it for a while. She came off medication. And you know, some of the obsessing returned, but between the passage of time and the fact that we had really reinforced this more complex thought about the guy, we got her to a point where she was able to move on.
Before I come to Peter and Webster, Peter and Webster, stay on the phone. Just to follow up on that point, and forgive the lay nature of this question,
right,
but for a patient like Olivia, who had these obsessing sort of self-sabotage, or at least that's my perspective. She has all these challenges. You put her on Zoloft. I think Zoloft was the medication. And it helped significantly. Now she goes off. Can you help a patient when they are on medication become self-aware of their tendencies, recognize how to deal with them for the time that they will be off the medication?
Well, yes. That certainly is what I try to do. I think combining medication with psychotherapy and just with kind of reinforcing this more flexible perspective is helpful. Is it always protective? No. People, you know, depression is one of these recurring and relapsing ailments. People, this was not a case of full depression, but people certainly may get depressed again. And I think part of what we try to do is get people to recognize what early depression looks and feels like, because depression is one of those ailments that has impediments to its own treatment built into it. As you start to get depressed, you think, well, I deserve to feel this way. I'm doing these things all wrong, and so on. And I think if you recognize, oh, no, that is a sign that I'm about to slip into depression. It's not what I would think if I weren't already partly in the state. Training in that kind of self-observation, I think, is an important part of what psychiatry does today.
And a listener named Ryan emailed to ask, what is your message for people who have decided to stop taking medication? Ryan is referencing a family member who has decided to stop. Apparently, Ryan writes that they were not being forthright with family members about continuing medication, but eventually admitted that they felt compelled to stop because they felt like they were strong enough to stop, didn't need it anymore, could live without it.
Yeah. I think it's good to listen to family members, to listen to people who know you well and have your interests in mind. I mean, obviously some do, some don't. And there are families who are destructive and undermining. But I think if you have a good, solid family, it's helpful in general. And I think if they say, look, I know you think you're ready, but we know you. And when you were well, you were a little better than this. And maybe a few more weeks or months are indicated. That's certainly something to take into account. And I think that is one of the functions of a good psychiatrist also, is observation over time and saying, working out with you when is a good time to stop. But I'm a big fan of stopping. There's lots of evidence that when people have been severely depressed, very suicidal, when they've had 2, 3, 4 episodes, that they ought to be on antidepressants so-called indefinitely, because the risk of coming off, risk of relapse is very great. when I was practicing, didn't always listen to that evidence. I thought that I knew my patients well enough, could work with them closely enough that I could take the chance often of taking people off medication and seeing how they did despite the statistics and see if they were going to be one of the ones who could stay off medication. And then to, you know, step in fast if things were going south.
But would you advise Ryan in working with his family member, or would you advise anyone who's on an antidepressant not to, quote, take themselves off without consulting with?
Boy, why not consult with other people?
Or doctor.
And especially with the doctor who's prescribing. Yes, I think, you know, it's good to get multiple perspectives because depression is a disorder of perspective.
All right, let's get back to your phone calls in Webster. This is Peter. Go ahead, Peter.
Hi, thanks. I'm wondering, as we have an aging population and people have been on medications for longer and longer periods, is there any evidence that suggests that people in their 80s and 90s need to continue with these medicines? Do they shift dosages or change medications, or what kind of things are going on with aging populations in these meds?
Yeah, no, that's a terrific question. And there's another part of it, which is, are side effects different as we age? There are worries that these medicines may contribute to falls, and falls prognostically are very bad for old people. People who, you know, break a hip, the odds of their living, you know, all of a sudden diminish. Even though that seems like something that medicine can handle. Is there bone fragility? Do people have more trouble driving as they get older relative to being on medicine? These are difficult questions. I would tend to lower people's doses as they got older. Sometimes that worked, sometimes it didn't.
Does that help, Peter?
Yeah. Just wondering if anybody's doing any studies in that in terms of aging population and these meds.
Yeah, no, I mean, there are studies, but it's not an area that we know about that well. And, you know, the funny thing about these medicines, despite lots of public resistance, doubt, skepticism, and so on, is that they have been relatively safe, that people have have been able to be on them for much longer times than they were ever tested for or expected to be used for and into older ages.
Working through, Joanne wants to know, Joanne also calling from Webster, wanted to ask, did your guest receive any speaking fees or paybacks from pharmaceutical companies during his career?
Terrific question. No.
And it's a fair question, isn't it?
No, I think that's a really important question. We want to know what influences, open, subtle, people have been under. The British Medical Journal had a list of doctors that they recommended journalists talk to because they had never taken drug company money or hadn't taken it in a number of years in some cases. It's a list of a little over 100 experts. I think six of them on the original list were psychiatrists. I am one of them. The list has been repeated. I've stayed on the list. I don't take drug company money. I did go out to Lilly headquarters when I wrote Listening to Prozac. I paid for my own transportation, hotel, lunch. No.
And here is Ellen, who writes in from Rochester. Does Dr. Kramer think that some psychiatrists are too quick to prescribe antidepressants? After only two sessions with a therapist, she told me I should think about taking antidepressants. I didn't think I needed them. I told her I wanted to focus on approaches that did not involve medication yet. Well, during the next session, she pushed the drugs even more, so I stopped seeing her.
Yeah. I don't, have an answer. And as I say, it's not my practice. There certainly is a lot of concern about generalists, internists, gynecologists, family doctors giving medication right away. I don't know if that's right either. Maybe that they know the patients and their families very well and recognize when something is wrong. But, that certainly is part of the public discussion. There's a lot of worry about medicines being given too fast. I think there are psychiatrists who are not big fans of psychotherapy and who, primarily think that medication is the right treatment for depression. And of course, if they recognize that, they will give medication fairly early.
Holly in East Rochester, next on the phone. Go ahead, Holly.
Hello. I'm in my car. Can you hear me okay?
I can. Go ahead.
Okay. You were talking earlier about that you're a big fan of people going off the meds, and I, too, am a big fan of that. I've tried 3 times over a 20-year period to go off my meds. The third time, I was in a really good place emotionally, family-wise, the whole thing. And a really unusual thing happened to me, I thought, was that my symptoms of depression came back, but I wasn't depressed. I couldn't focus. My words wouldn't come. It was very, very strange. Almost like I never even considered that that happened because I went off my meds. My doctor told me that. So I'm just wondering, how common is that of a reaction when people do go off their meds to have these other symptoms of depression but not be depressed?
You know, I don't know the answer to that. That is, when I said there's a lively web discussion of this, there, you know, are these reports of people feeling foggy sometime after coming off medicine. I don't know whether they come off fast or slow. Slow by my standards is probably slower than what studies of slow taper are talking about. Yes, you know, I haven't seen this response, but people certainly talk about it, and I suspect, you know, it was that's what you were experiencing, was sort of a slow withdrawal effect.
Joe writes to us and says, if different drugs work for different people, isn't it possible that any one of them individually would show up as ineffective in studies or a meta-analysis?
Right. Well, I mean, when we bring a, you know, a drug company brings a drug to market, when the FDA looks at a drug, they want it to work enough of the time. Mm-hmm. So it's true that by, you know, setting a standard that it needs to work for a large number of people, we may be missing medicines that, if we had them to hand, would work for a few people. You know, that just is a problem throughout all of medicine. The same would be true for a blood pressure pill. You know, so there's another question whether what we call biological plausibility ought to be a factor in letting drugs come to market. So if there's a reason to believe a medicine should work, it works in mice and monkeys, and it works in some people but not a large number, are we going to believe that it's inherently effective, that those people are getting better because of the drug or not? But, you know, on the whole, the drugs that doctors use are drugs that help large numbers of people, not ones that help a few, except in some cutting-edge fields, you know, where there really are patient-centered approaches to cancer treatment, say.
Okay, and down to our last couple of minutes, just building on that, Peter's book, the subtitle is The Case for Antidepressants. I can think of quite a few people who tried an antidepressant, declared that it didn't work for them, didn't want to try another one. Right. I remember my own experience as a migraine patient in the 1990s. Imitrex was what I was supposed to take. And I remember, you know, 20 years later, all of a sudden I start having a lot more migraines. And I remember being told, well, a lot's changed in 20 years. If Imitrex doesn't work, there's a family that we can keep trying. Don't give up after just one. Have we seen similar change? And would you have a similar message for people with antidepressants, that if one isn't effective, that doesn't mean antidepressants as a category is not effective?
No, absolutely. I think that just is doctor's experience, that you try one, it doesn't work, and you try another. And, you know, that is why these studies don't really tell us enough. We have a drug that, if someone is a non-responder, it's countered against the drug in that study. But it may be that same patient, you know, it will be a responder to another drug. And in clinical practice, we just see that all the time.
Down to our last minute, and again, it's tonight, 5 p.m. in the Hawkins Carlson's room of Rush Reese Library at the University of Rochester. Peter's event is free and open to the public and part of the Humanities Center's public lecture series. So tonight, 5 p.m., this impacts so many people. What do you hope the audience takes away from your presentation tonight?
So I'm talking about a slightly different issue than what we've been talking about now, which is good. It won't be all that much overlap, but I'm really going to speak about how we think about psychiatrists as experts and what we demand in the way of evidence for a psychiatric treatment and how that's changed over time. So do we want to believe our doctors, or do we want to be radical skeptics and cynics?
The book is called Ordinarily Well, The Case for Antidepressants. I mentioned earlier when I referred to Peter's, quote, first book in 1993. I'm not even sure that was his first book, just the first of two on the subject that we've been talking about. He's written about a wide range of things and has expertise in a wide range of subjects. But we're really grateful for the work here. You can see our audience connects to it. It impacts everybody. It certainly does. So we wish you well in your event here. And thank you, Peter, for taking the time to come on the program today.
Good. Thank you.
Peter Kramer, Ordinarily Well, The Case for Antidepressants. Short break, more connections coming up.